Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The advent of the antibiotic era revolutionized the field of medicine. No longer would we be subject to contagion, disfigurement, or early death because of microbes. But our success has been short-lived in evolutionary terms. Now, because of the selective pressure put on the bacterial and viral worlds with our many medications, these nimble organisms are able to quickly adapt and learn how to counter our weapons. However, the rise of molecular biology and techniques for sequencing genetic information offer new hope. One area of particularly fertile growth is the study of the human microbiome, which is the mass of bacteria that live inside of us and on our skin. Collectively, there are 100 trillion of these tiny critters that are invisible to the naked eye, 100-fold more than the number of cells in our body. Our increasing awareness of the microbiome has led researchers to some interesting observations. Among them are some new treatments for which antibiotics are not effective, and the notion that the bacteria living in our digestive tracts can play a role in our emotional state. My guest today, Sean Gibbons, a postdoctoral fellow at MIT, is steeped in this line of inquiry. He works in the Department of Biological Engineering there and has written extensively about the importance of the microbiome and made discoveries in the field. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa on Health. Sean Gibbons, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. Let's start with the concept of microbiome. You know, what is it, and why do you think it's become a more prominent topic of discussion in popular science as of late?
So the microbiome is this cloud of microorganisms that lives in and on our bodies. Many people may have heard the basic numbers of there's about a trillion human cells in our body and 100 trillion bacterial cells. So they outnumber us by quite a lot. Actually, a lot of the genetic component of what we are as well is microbial. So it's this huge fraction of our bodies that has been rather unexplored for a long time. And the main reason it's gone unexplored is that there was just wasn't the technology to be able to look into it. Essentially, sequencing technology caught up to the point where we are now able to measure and assess who's there.
So it's really the tools of science that have allowed us to really kind of, is it in fact that it's allowed us to see the bacteria that live on us and in us, or is it that we kind of always knew they were there, but we didn't really have any way to do the studies?
We always knew they were there. You could grow them on agar plates. You could isolate them, look at them under the microscope. But we always knew that the stuff that we could grow was only a small minority of what's actually there. There's something called the Great Plate Count Anomaly that somebody figured out back in the 20th century. When you look under the microscope, you see a whole bunch of bacteria. But then when you try to plate those out and grow them, you're only able to culture about 1% of what you can see under the microscope.
I've never
heard
that.
So we're only able to like actually get our hands on a small minority. And in addition, when you're looking under the microscope, you can't distinguish between things. You know, morphologically, bacteria look pretty similar. And so it's only with this, you know, cracking these guys open and looking at their genomes that we've been able to really assess the vast scale of the diversity that was under that microscope.
So has anyone figured out why there is that anomaly? Why is it we can't plate and grow in the lab this multitude of samples? Why do so many die off?
That's an active area of research. There's a great hypothesis that came out a few years ago called the Black Queen Hypothesis, an evolutionary hypothesis, which states that essentially microbial communities living in the environment, they sort of divide up labor in a sense, but they can share functionality. There are certain functions that are leaky. So one great example in this paper was the surface ocean. There is a lot of oxygen radicals floating around the surface ocean. And what those are just these, they're like little molecular bombs. And if you encounter them, they destroy your biomolecules. And they're produced when UV light hits water and breaks water into pieces. So these need to be detoxified. And there are genes that do that. One's called catalase. But the most abundant things living in the surface ocean do not carry those catalase genes. So they should, by all accounts, be dead. But it seems that their neighbors do harbor those genes, and since these little molecules diffuse across membranes, their neighbors are able to sort of decontaminate the region, the space around these other organisms. And so they've outsourced that functionality to their neighbor. So we think that this outsourcing of function occurs on a vast scale, such that when you take an organism out of its community context, there are all sorts of vitamins or little things that it needs. They're very fastidious. And it's very difficult for us as humans to engineer the growth conditions that allow us to grow them all in the lab.
Interesting. So, I mean, I'm going to get to that in a second because you're actually in a department of biological engineering. And so I sort of took that in one way. But in some ways, you're saying the engineering of a system in which you could reproduce, in a sense, what exists in the natural world in the laboratory would allow you to study, I guess, natural phenomena better. But I'll come back to that. So 100 trillion organisms live essentially on and in all of us. I mean, so more, as you said, more organisms than cells in our body. And I think I heard you say on a video of yours that I watched that if you totaled up all the bacteria that live within us, it's something like 3 pounds of mass. I mean, there's the 3 pounds of bacteria on our bodies or in our bodies. I mean, that's kind of shocking. And you said it weighs as much as the human brain. So you look at the microbiome as an organ, right? I mean, that was kind of the analogy you used. And I guess I'm curious, what kind of organ is it?
It's a very slippery one. It has a mind of its own. It's not an organ in a traditional sense, for sure. But, you know, a lot of people are talking about it as an organ these days. And there's a lot of attention being paid to it in medicine now because we're finding all these connections with a dysbiosis or a disruption of your native microbiota and negative health consequences. So, like the Black Queen thing I was talking about before, outsourcing functionality to your neighbors, we've done the same thing with our microbiome. And they've done the same thing for us as well. So there are certain things that we do for our microbes that they require, and there's certain things that they do for us that we require. And we're just starting to piece together what all those things are. But, you know, for example, a lot of the nutrition that we get from our foods, we don't have the genes to break down certain things or produce certain vitamins. And so that is all provided to us through our microbiome. There are certain compounds, like, for example, butyrate, that seem to be very important for training our immune system and upregulating certain types of immune cells that prevent things like autoimmune disorders. So I think we're just fundamentally entangled evolutionarily, like over the past several hundred thousand years since humans diverged from whatever the last hominid was. We've been evolving with these things, and we're completely coupled together. And we don't quite understand what modern human lifestyles are doing to that coupling. Like, obviously, we don't live and behave as we did 10,000 years ago. We take antibiotics. We're very cleanly. We live indoors. And it seems that these behaviors are reshaping our microbiome, this organ, in ways that are causing disease. And so this is just an active area of research we're just beginning to understand.
So essentially, our microbiome has evolved alongside of us and with us. And I guess that for me, it raises the question of, you know, we're talking about humans and you talk about evolution, but what about other animals like our pets, you know, dogs, cats, et cetera, the common ones, but then, you know, farm animals, they all have their own microbiomes, I guess, and this may be certainly beyond what you look at, but anything you could say about how, you know, co-living with a pet, you know, changes a microbiome, or is that known in some of the scientific literature, or how microbiota have evolved for our animal friends?
Yeah, there's less to say on that topic. So on the topic of coevolution, it's definitely true that different organisms and different branches of the tree of life harbor differential microbiota. There's a great paper by Howard Ackman from a few years ago showing that you could recapitulate the great ape tree, gorillas, chimpanzees, humans, bonobos, through their gut microbiomes. You could essentially get the same tree relationship through their gut microbes as you get from mitochondrial DNA. So it seems that there is this vertical line of descent, not only through our genome, but also through our microbiome. And whether or not those microbes are passed vertically from mother to child, or whether we're just sort of sorting microbes from the environment based on our genotype, or a combination of those two things, that's still being worked out. But yes, it seems like there's this coupling evolutionarily between microbes and their hosts across all animals. And there has been recent work on humans cohabitating with animals. So a paper from 2 years ago, when I was in grad school, I was on a paper. Simon Lax was the first author in Jack Gilbert's lab, where they looked at the home microbiome, where they sequenced the surfaces of homes, like kitchen counters, floors, everything, and also the inhabitants. And we're asking whether or not you could see signatures of different people in different homes. And indeed, they found that you could track individuals based on their interaction with surfaces. You could see their microbial signatures inside of buildings. But interestingly, if they had a house pet, like a dog or a cat, it seems that they act as sort of a conduit or a way to accelerate exchange of microbiota between bringing in more diverse microbiota from outside into the house. And this may or may not have a health implication, but there is also work, I believe, in Hutterite and Amish populations, which are these two sort of genetically homogenous populations, religious populations that are, that kind of live separately, but they have very different lifestyles, where the Amish allow their young children to work out in the barnyard and interact with animals and play in the dirt, whereas the Hutterites are a little more sterile upbringing, and you don't actually work on the farm until you're an adolescent. And they find that the incidence of autoimmune disorders and allergies and things like this are much higher in the Hutterite population, or not much higher, but they seem to be statistically higher in the Hutterite population than in the Amish population. But this is all preliminary work, and it's ongoing.
Wow, that is very interesting. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. Our guest is Sean Gibbons, who's a postdoctoral associate at MIT in the Department of Biological Engineering, and we're talking about the microbiome, the idea that trillions of bacterial organisms live inside of us and on our skin, and science is really just coming to an understanding of how this is impactful for our health, both for our well-being and in disease states. And Sean Gibbons, I wanted to pick up asking you essentially about a talk that you gave where you just alluded to the differences in the Hutterite and the, was it the Amish populations, where essentially the idea that the Hutterites, who I guess are more clean or cleanly and don't let their kids interact in the dirt or on the farm earlier, seems to correlate with this higher incidence of autoimmune disease or what we might think of as allergies. Or the name of your talk was, you know, Are We Dirty Enough? And I guess it's a pretty provocative title, and I was wondering kind of what you're getting at. I mean, is the idea that, and you had alluded to this earlier, are we sterilizing our environment so much that we're, you know, causing ourselves harm?
Yeah, that's the big question. And the hypothesis that question's couched in is the hygiene hypothesis, which has been around for a while, and it was developed because we've been seeing a rise in industrialized countries in a lot of autoimmune-related disorders like rheumatoid arthritis and asthma and irritable bowel syndrome. And so, and we don't really know why. But it seems more and more as we look into it, there is a microbial component. Whether or not it's causal is being worked out. But it seems that the more sterile, the more cleanly you are, there are negative health implications. So one example is C-section versus natural birth. There's a couple studies looking at infants that were born via C-section or born via vaginal birth, and I believe this is Roth Knight's group, who showed that the microbiome, the gut microbiome of these children, these infants, a few weeks after being born, resembled, if they were vaginally born, their mother's vaginal microbiota. And if they were born via C-section, it resembled her skin. So that's sort of our starter culture, right? Like, this is how we've been born for a long time, and we know now that the infant microbiome is very noisy for the first couple few months, and definitely maybe first couple of years. It sort of bounces around and looks very different from what we would call an adult microbiota. But then it settles down and becomes fairly stable, and it starts to look more like what we see in all adults. But that process of succession may be fragile and seems to perhaps be disrupted by differential treatment, being born in different ways. So there are some statistics showing that, you know, children born via C-section have a higher incidence of like autism or asthma, things like that. So that's one line of evidence for this hygiene hypothesis. But there's also a lot of work being done looking at different communities who have different relationships with nature, whether your children are urban or rural, whether they interact with animals, whether they interact with crops, agriculture, what is the effect on your microbiota? Also, the taking of antibiotics. How frequently do you take antibiotics? Antibiotics are a huge perturbation to your microbiome and can strip away or weed away diversity. So what are we losing? Are we permanently losing things over time? Every time we go through one of these bottlenecks, these are questions that are unanswered, but it seems that there's a link there, and that this hygiene hypothesis, this rise in incidence of all these autoimmune disorders is related to our cleanliness as a society.
And you wrote a piece that's you link to on your website. I think you call it about the collateral damage of antibiotics. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes. So that was a study in MBio, and they were looking. It was one of the first large scale studies of its kind, where they were looking at the effects of different antibiotics on large cohorts of human patients. So these were healthy patients, and they were dosed with, I think there were four different antibiotics. There were two populations. One was in England, and one was in one of the Scandinavian countries. And they showed that there was a big change, there was a big perturbation to your gut microbiome when you take antibiotics, that this persists in the gut, but not in the mouth. So they sequenced both the saliva microbiome and the gut microbiome. The saliva recovered almost instantaneously. It very rapidly came back to its original set point, but the gut seemed to take many, many months to recover. And we see problems associated with antibiotic treatment, like, for example, Clostridium difficile, which I mentioned earlier, I think. It's an infection that you get in your lower GI tract when you wipe out the diversity of your colon. So if the ecological diversity of your microbial community in your lower colon crashes for whatever reason, either you have some sort of disease, autoimmune disorder, or you take a long antibiotic treatment trial, this will wipe out your native microbes and leave the niche space open for this pathogen to invade. And when it invades, it becomes dominant, it causes really severe diarrhea and prevents reestablishment of the native community. Yeah, I think taking antibiotics makes you more susceptible, makes you opens you up to invasion by outsiders, by pathogens, the weedy species.
And it's been very prevalent, I would say, in some of the lay literature as well, that Clostridium difficile, as it's known, this bacterium that can cause this pathological kind of diarrhea, has increasingly become resistant to standard antibiotics. And so there's been this development of a novel strategy for treating antibiotic-resistant Clostridium difficile, which is really to essentially transplant the healthy fecal microbiota from, I guess, a healthy patient or a family member, all the way to now where you've told me that there are commercial companies who are developing these essentially just pills full of these bacteria that wind up helping patients with Clostridium difficile repopulate the sort of healthy bacteria in their colon. Does that work?
That's correct, and it works. It's sort of magical. It's, I guess, the driving force behind why microbial ecology has moved into medicine. It's a big success story. Essentially, these recurrent cases of Clostridium difficile, they're antibiotic-resistant strains of C. difficile, and actually even more virulent strains. So the strains today produce more of the toxin that causes diarrhea than they used to 30 years ago. So they're more pathogenic and they're resistant to antibiotics. And about 30,000 U.S. citizens die every year from this disease. And I think about 450,000 are diagnosed with C. difficile infections. About, I think, half or so are cured in the first round of antibiotics, but then maybe 40% of patients recur, have a recurrence of C. difficile. And once that happens, the chances that the further antibiotic treatment are going to cure them decline rapidly. So there are these people who are stuck in this loop of continually having to take these rounds of antibiotics, which do depress the population of C. difficile. It can't grow under the conditions of having antibiotics present, but they form spores, which are these tough seeds that can lay dormant and wait for the antibiotics to go away, and then they'll bloom again when you go off the antibiotics. And so the patients are stuck, and the last-ditch thing to do is to actually just remove the colon altogether, which, you know, is a horrible option, and a lot of people die just from that alone. So it's amazing that if you just transplant fecal material from a healthy donor into one of these recurrent C. difficile patients, you see in over 90%, in some studies, depending on what study you look at, it's, you know, above 80 or 90% of people on the first round of treatment are overnight cured of their C. difficile infection. And the basic intuition behind how it happens or why it happens is there are organisms that normally reside in our gut. There are also spore formers in the group Clostridia. And they seem to kind of inhabit the niche space that C. difficile would normally try to inhabit. And in their presence, they actually suppress the growth of C. difficile. So if you can re-inject the intact ecosystem from another person into a sick person's gut, kind of boost the successional process and bring them back to a healthy state, you just instantaneously get rid of the disease.
That is truly amazing. You have on your website, there are a couple of other links to other, I guess, uses or theories, at least from the bacterial world. One of them is about the use of bacterial technology or these techniques in forensics. That is, I guess, criminal science, trying to understand where, you know, criminal activities occurred and then using the microbiome that's left behind, as it were, to try to track people down or solve crimes. Is that something that is like mainstream now, or is this all theoretical at this point?
The idea that it can be done is, I would say, becoming mainstream. So when I was in grad school, my fellow student Simon Lax and I published a study together. We sequenced our phones and our shoes every couple hours for 48 hours. And we showed that with like 95% accuracy, you could always distinguish whose phone was whose by the microbial signature. So my phone looked like my skin microbiome and Simon's like his skin, and they were very easily distinguishable. The soles of our shoes looked very much like the ground we were walking on. So if we sequenced the microbes on the ground adjacent to where we were walking, we could match the profiles very, very closely to what we were walking on with our shoes. So it seems like, yes, like microbial communities are easily deposited and picked up from different surfaces.
What's the difference between, I mean, if, let's say you and your colleague were, you know, like roommates, and so you lived in close proximity and you walked to work the kind of the same way, but maybe you had, you know, you had an Apple and the other one had a Samsung phone or something. So there was a slight difference, but what percentage difference, I mean, how unique could that signature be between you?
It's quite unique. So for example, there was this home microbiome study paper published in Science a couple years ago. And they looked at people living together in the same home. And you could distinguish every individual's microbial signature within the home by sequencing the surfaces of the home. So people were depositing their signature, and those signatures were distinguishable. There was an example where the husband in one family went on a business trip a couple of times, and when he left, you could see his signature decay from the home and return when he came back. And there was another case where there was a couple living together with a lodger. They had another roommate living in the basement, and it looks like the amount of interaction you have with someone else defines how microbially similar you are. So you could distinguish all three of these people fairly easily, but the couple looked a lot more similar to each other than they did to the roommate.
I'm so curious about this, but I'll come back to it in a second. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. Our guest is Sean Gibbons. He's a postdoctoral associate at Massachusetts Institute of Technologies in the Department of Biological Engineering. We're talking about the microbiome, the bacteria that live inside and on all of us. And we were talking about forensics. I guess, is it the signature that's given off by bacteria? Is it the actual mixture of different bacterial species that's unique to the individual? Or is it the byproducts? Or is it the genetic information?
So it could be different things. So an example that I was giving, what we did there was sample a given surface or a skin or something on a person, a cotton swab with a little bit of water, a sterile swab, and then take that and extract all the bacterial cells and then pop them open until they spill their guts, then grab their DNA. And in this particular example, we were just sequencing a particular gene from all these different organisms, the 16S gene, it's ribosomal rRNA gene. And it can be used as a barcode, essentially, to identify species. So by the number of counts of these different genes, as we sequence from these different samples, we can build a profile of that sample as to what organisms were there and what abundances were they there in. And so that's the profile I was talking about. But there are other ways to build that profile. You could also do what's called shotgun metagenomic sequencing, and that's where you bust up the entire genome of everything in your sample, and you just sequence everything randomly. You just kind of sequence everything up. And so you get like a mixture of all the genomes that were in your sample. So you get not only, you know, sort of snapshots of who's there, but also what functionality they have, what sort of enzymes they're using, things like that. And then there are other, they're called omics techniques, or kind of high-throughput molecular techniques. You could look at proteomics. You could look at the profile of proteins that were on the surface. You could look at metabolomics, the kind of small molecules left behind by microbial communities. So there are different ways to probe, but they're all kind of molecular-based methods.
That is absolutely fascinating. It just really sounds like science fiction to me, but that's amazing that that's going to happen. I have one more question with regard to applications or knowledge about the microbiome. which is about mood. And it seems like there's been some work done relatively recently suggesting that these bacteria that live to a large extent in our gut have a rather profound impact on our emotional health. I mean, how can that be?
Yes, there is work being done on this. There are several studies that are very promising. Of course, I should preface all this by saying, like, you know, I'm very excited about the rapidity of how things are moving in this field and all the advances. But I think we got to be careful about overselling the microbiome because it is so exciting, at least it's in this initial phase, and there's so much promise in all the correlations we're seeing. But correlation and causation are two very different things. So we're still sorting through, you know, what's the smoking gun and what is actually causing these different changes in the host. But it does seem clear in certain cases that your microbial community can influence your psychological state. So there's one I like to bring up, which is, I think it's called PANDAS, something like that. Since it's the same bacterium that gives you strep throat, some children, when they contract this organism, they do not exhibit a sore throat, but instead they exhibit obsessive-compulsive disorder. And you can cure their obsessive-compulsive disorder if you catch it early enough with antibiotics. So that's just a kind of one small example of how a disruption of your microbial community can lead to some sort of psychosis. But there are other examples of, you know, microbes maybe modulating our appetite or even our cravings for certain types of food. There's a nerve that goes directly to our brain from our stomach called the vagus nerve. And they've shown that microbes, small molecules emitted by microbes, can actually interact with that nerve. In mice, they've shown that courageousness can be affected by their microbiome. So they have this test where there's this long walkway that's exposed on either side with a long drop. And so most mice will kind of huddle on the side of this walkway, and they won't want to venture out onto it. But certain mice are braver than others, and they found that the brave mice and the mice that were more timid had differential microbiota. And there's many more examples, but you know, there have been links to things like autism or other psychological disorders.
Man, that is just really surprising.
Yeah, we don't know the extent of it yet.
Right.
Yeah.
We're in there definitely the early stages. And then, of course, the irony of treating a psychotic condition with antibiotics would be we would not want to cause Clostridium difficile diarrhea.
Right.
Well, congratulations on your work. It's truly fascinating, and we'll put up a link to your website on our Studio Tulsa homepage. You can listen to any of our shows at studiotulsa.org. Sean Gibbons, postdoctoral associate at MIT in the Department of Biological Engineering, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Gibbons is a postdoctoral associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the Department of Biological Engineering. He's an expert on the human microbiome. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a recent show, you can listen online anytime. Just go to studiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.